Hello, welcome to episode 28 of Extra Sequential, the podcast hosted out of Perth, Western Australia, hosted by me, Mladen,
and myself, Chris, who's a bit sick, not love sick, but just sick, and has been spending more time in bed this week than Charlie Sheen.
But I hope you're not sick about talking comics, because that's what we're going to be doing, talking comics, graphic novels, and manga on this podcast of ours, and today we're not going to focus on Valentine's Day. That plan kind of fell through due to my lack of planning, and everyone can blame me.
Are you honest? Yeah, well, we are going to talk about, apart from the news of what we've been reading, we're going to talk about some recent romance comics that we've been reading.
Yep, and we're going to do a feature review of a brand new comic called Ivy by a young lady who I'm just...
She's got a strange name. She's got a strange surname. Sarah Alexi.
Ah, okay, yeah. But that's what we'll be reviewing later. And for now, I think we should get into the news for this week.
First up for the news, the new Wonder Woman TV series, the On Again, Off Again. I suppose that could be considered romance, On Again, Off Again. The new Wonder Woman TV series to be developed by David E. Kelly, husband of Michelle Pfeiffer, creator of Boston Legal and the other
Ally
one
McBeal.
With the woman in it.
Ally McBeal.
That's the one. Has found their Wonder Woman, Adrian Palicki, who was in that bad Angels Come to Small Diner in Texas or wherever, and, you know,
touched by an
each
angel?
Other with Legion.
Oh, okay.
the TV series Friday Night Lights. So she's been cast as Wonder Woman, which is described thusly: Wonder Woman / Diana Prince is a vigilante crime fighter in LA, but also a successful corporate executive and a modern woman trying to balance all of the elements of her extraordinary life. I'm already falling asleep by the end of that sentence, so it just sounds like she's going to be a super-powered it girl trying to get it all together.
She's interesting. There's a audition tape that's out of the actual audition she did for this role, which gives you a pretty...
I don't think that's her. That's another actress. That's Tanit Phoenix. I don't think Palicki's audition tape is out.
Okay, it does show what we might be in store for in terms of dialogue and the kind of tone of the show. And it does seem
cheesy.
It's been described as like she's like a female Tony Stark character. And in this, she's talking about her bra size, like during a business meeting. I don't know if it's just the performance of this girl who didn't get the role, but it looks pretty bad, I've got to say.
Yeah.
But maybe it's just
I don't
not
know why Warner
me.
Brothers let this kind of stuff happen, but, you know.
I think she's a really impossible character to work with. I mean, I don't know a lot about her. Maybe it's incredibly accurate to her comic book character. Maybe she works for the UN or something. Am I misremembering that?
You are misremembering that.
She does some sort of government. She's the spokesperson, like this.
Yeah, she's
ambassador
like a representative
or something.
Of her people, the famous Euro Island. But yeah, she was like for a while. She's been a whole bunch of different things.
Right.
And you're right, she's had more worse runs in her comic book series than any other character. But when she's done well, Greg Rucka, who does a lot of crime comics, he done a fantastic run. And I've got a few of his issues of her.
I hear good things about Gail Simone's run as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
They should have got one of those two to do the show. But yeah, sorry, go on.
I know. But yeah, so she's kind of in a weird place, one of those characters that very few writers kind of understand. But she's been around for, almost 80 years. And I think if they just, you know, I guess the problem is that networks are scared of female-centric action TV shows.
I think they don't know what
really.
To
do. I mean, we saw the Terminator Sarah Connor Chronicles, I guess, didn't last that well, and Buffy was successful, but kind of a cult thing, and I don't know, so I suppose they're trying to make it all hip, and, you know, she's going to be bringing different boys home and whatever, but why do they need Wonder Woman for this? They can just do any old character.
You're very, this is very close to your heart, is it?
Well, what's the point of reinventing the wheel with this 80-year-old icon of pop culture, if you're just going to take it.
Smallville.
By the rights. Well, yeah, but that works, and that's out of a lot of comic writers' work for it. Stays true to the roots of Superman, you know. He's not, they're not turning him into some kind of, you know,
yeah. I think they're
different character, whereas this sounds like she's just some any old character. You know,
there's a line here that she says in the performance where she's big tits save lives. That's about says all we need to say about this show. In other sort of, I guess, casting news, in a project that's I'm terrified of and I don't really want to follow, but I guess I have to, the American remake of Akira. Now, as if we haven't seen New York destroyed before in a movie, first they figured, well, no one wants to see a foreign city get destroyed. It has to be New York again. And because Warner Brothers was a little bit burnt on Watchmen, they're trying to improve their, you know, big blockbusters by starring major talents or recognizable faces. And apparently Brad Pitt was offered the role of, like, the 17-year-old Canada in Akira. that says it. That just seems like such a wrong direction. I can't even explain. The whole point is that they're teenagers and they can't control their, you know, emotions and all that business. But James Franco also was apparently offered the part of Tetsuo. He's still got a bit of a baby face, so he might be able to do it, you know. But Brad Pitt? No. Bob Hoskins was offered the role of Akira.
Did you look at that link I sent you ages ago about a guy who was collecting all the original art from Akira?
That's right, yeah. Because with a lot of animated films, a lot of the backgrounds, any kind of storyboard stuff just gets thrown out when it's done or reused. So that one guy, if I'm thinking of the right link you sent, he's trying to collate all that stuff and put together like an exhibition. And because Akira, which was like a first for like Japanese anime in the sense of they went to like the full, what is it? How many frames per second is it? It's a lot.
24?
24. They went for like the movie frame rate, and they did it like the way of recording voices first and then doing the animations rather than the other way, which is the traditional way that you see in cartoons and so forth. And as it's a pretty exquisite film, and he was showing in that little video how in half a second in the far background between these two buildings, you see this background, and then he found like the original artwork, and it's this, you know, stunningly drawn background that you see for half a second in the film, and it just goes the detail involved. So that'll be a good exhibition. I wish we could go.
Yeah.
Shame we're in Perth.
Yeah, I think there's talk of putting it in, you know, book as well, so hopefully that'll come to our shores at one point. Spider-Man, the Spider-Man film, the second official picture has been released with Andrew Garfield actually in the full-bodied costume, kind of striking a pose. Well, we're told that it's Andrew Garfield. That's his name, isn't it? Andrew Garfield?
Yeah, Andrew Garfield, yeah.
It's got a name. The Amazing Spider-Man, and it opens on July 3, 2012 in 3D, of course. So, yeah, it'll be called The Amazing Spider-Man, the new Spider-Man reboot.
I like the name.
And, it's also the name of Spider-Man's longest-running comic series that Marvel's been doing, so it kind of makes sense. Marvel vs. Capcom 3, the video game is out, Fate of Two Worlds. There's also downloadable content being released on March 1. For $5, you can get a whole bunch of different costumes for the playable characters, including Thor in his classic costume, Iron Patriot, and Steve Rogers. So I'm not a big fan of fighting games, but apparently this one is meant to be pretty good. Mm-hmm. Shane Black is directing Iron Man 3. He wrote Lethal Weapon, co-wrote the second one. He wrote Long Kiss Goodnight, the Hitman film with Samuel L. Jackson in it.
Right.
He wrote and directed Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which was about 4 or 5 years ago, a pretty good film starring Val Kilmer and Robert Downey Jr., who will also, of course, be in Iron Man 3. So Jon Favreau is directing a film for Disney, I think, called The Magic Kingdom. So he had to step away from that. But, yeah, Shane Black is directing Iron Man 3. So he knows his buddy cop kind of stuff good. He's usually got some good tongue-in-cheek humour, and he's pretty good on the old action films. So that should be a good one to look out for. But, yeah, it'll be another 2 years away at least, because The Avengers will be first before Iron Man 3 is out.
In other news, and I'll keep it comics just for the moment, Matthew Vaughan's adapting The Golden Age, which I think is a comic that hasn't even come out yet, by Jonathan Ross and Tommy Lee Edwards. And he's aiming for Clint Eastwood, Jack Nicholson, and Warren Beatty to star. Or Warren Beatty, I should say. Which, that'd be a pretty amazing cast if you can get that together. So, but I still can't really imagine, Warren Beatty would do it. I can't imagine Clint Eastwood wanting to do a superhero film of any kind.
No, well, I think Warren Beatty's pretty much retired, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
When was the last time he was in a film?
That's a fact. Let's see, Dick Tracy That was kind of a... so he's not above comics, and he directed that himself, if I recall.
That's true.
Yeah.
His wife's still acting.
And Jack Nicholson
clearly is. We should point out that the Golden Age is based on aging superheroes who are retired, and then they team up with their grandkids, I think, because they're middle-aged parents kind of ruin the world, so they team up and teach the young'uns a thing or two.
I see. That makes sense, because the picture I see here has people with hoodies. I'm like, that's not old school. Hoodies aren't old school.
Yeah.
In other comic-y news, Darren Aronofsky's shooting along with his... he's doing a graphic novel called Noah, and it's sort of... His concept is to sort of bring out the stories that are censored out of people's religious upbringing. So, like, expanding on, you know, the kind of stories in the Bible that are a bit forgotten, and sort of Noah, not his early years, but the parts you don't really know about him, like how he grows a vineyard, gets drunk, and all sorts of crazy stuff. There's lots of interesting, crazy stuff that happens in certain parts of the Bible, I'm sure you can. And there's a lot of... It's an entertaining book. I'll give it that.
Yes, for sure. Noah, year one. So, Darren Aronofsky, year plus one.
That was good. Noah, you won. Very good. Yeah, Darren Aronofsky, Black Swan, Requiem for a Dream. So if there's some ass-to-ass action in Noah, we know who to thank. Michelle Gondry is adapting a Philip K. Dick novel, which to me is the coolest news I've heard this week, because they're kind of two of my favourite things together. I haven't watched The Green Hornet yet. I'm not interested, if I'm being honest. But I really love Philip K. Dick. He's adapting Ubik, which I remember reading, and I remember just being baffled by it, so I can't wait to see how he adapts it. So, very exciting.
Can you explain it in one sentence?
No, I don't even remember it that well.
okay.
Yeah, I'm just looking
it
up.
Has it got robots in it?
No, but you'd think so because of that name, wouldn't you? Mm. But if you don't know Philip K. Dick's novels, he tends to explore that the concept of reality, and then reality just breaking down around a person to the point where they can't trust anything that's happening around them. And usually it ends with, if you might remember A Scanner Darkly, the Keanu Reeves film, and at the end how it just, like, the plot just sort of derails, and it's just him, I think he's committed to a mental asylum or something odd like that. So I expect some weird imagery in this. And the last person to try one, I mean, other famous Philip K. Dick novels, you know, Blade Runner, based on Drowned Regime of Electric Sheep. And I think there's another one recent. Oh, yeah, of Total Recall, of all things.
Minority Report.
That's a good film. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, it's good. Spielberg directed it.
Yeah, like, I feel like everyone, like, craps all over that movie, but I remember it being really quite good. Huh.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I need to rewatch
that. It's got some good weapons in there.
Unless if you have any other news items, I've got one last one.
Go for it.
Yeah, yeah. Billy Mitchell, the antagonist of the King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters documentary about the rivalry between Steve Wiebe, who's challenging Billy Mitchell, the title holder for the championship of Donkey Kong Jr., you know, the game where you're Mario and you're climbing up the stairs and dodging the barrels. He's opened up a King of Kong arcade at Orlando Airport, cashing in on this film, which he apparently says he hasn't seen because it slanders him. And apparently there isn't a classic video game at all in the arcade. It's all new stuff, which kind of boggles the mind. And there's a picture of Steve Wiebe on the banner of the actual arcade. So clearly Steve given his approval for it. Anyway, I thought that was newsworthy the ongoing saga of Steve Wiebe and Billy Mitchell. Thank you. All right. Let's do what we've been reading after a little break.
All right,
Chris, you mentioned before that you've been sick this last week, so I'm assuming you might not have had the energy to read a comic.
Well, I haven't, so usually my usual Friday routine is, because in Australia we get new comics every Thursday/Friday, not Tuesday/Wednesday like everywhere else. So every Friday lunchtime when I'm at work, I go into my two comic shops and spend up big, well, not as big as I have been. But today I didn't because I've been sick, so I haven't actually read any new comics. But in between bouts of napping, I watched all four Lethal Weapon movies.
Really?
And the thing that I find interesting is that every plot on every film is kind of driven by coincidence. Like Riggs and Murtaugh they all just happen to be at the right place at the right time to discover the crime, and then that leads them into unraveling a big epic crime, and there's lots of shootout and witty banter and stuff. So like Lethal Weapon 4, which is the last one, with Jet Li in it.
Yes.
Jet Li's first smuggling American people. Film.
Yep.
Yes, well, Jet Li, because obviously he was a big star in Hong Kong, I guess, and he wanted to kind of make it big in America. He said, yes, I'll be the bad guy in this American film, but I want to be a good guy in my next film. So this is the only time he's actually been a bad guy. So yeah, Lethal Weapon 4, released in 1998, and it's got Mel Gibson, obviously, Danny Glover, Joe Pesci, Chris Rock. Gibson, Glover, and Pesci are all fishing on Danny Glover's boat. And all of a sudden, this illegal Chinese people smuggling vessel goes right past them in the middle of the ocean. It could have went past anyway. It goes right past them with shots firing, so they jump on it. Barrels explode all over the place, sharks swimming around. And that basically, that just that whole thing in the intro kicks off the whole plot of the people smuggling. So it's pretty, but it's funny. It's one of those, they're very well-written films, and they're such awesome just buddy cop movies, and they're just funny. There's just lots of zingers going back and forth. They're funny as well as well-made action films. Richard Donner, who directed my favourite movie of all time, Superman the Movie, directed all four Lethal Weapons. They're one of those guilty pleasure kind of movies, you know. And they're, and again, bad news or good news, they're remaking Lethal Weapons, so... I don't know who they're going to cast.
Channing Tatum and...
Oh, boy. Yes, the guy who cannot act.
Common? Maybe Common? Oh, I need a Hollywood job, eh? I'm perfect at this.
Or Tyrese from Transformers. Yeah, something like that. I don't know. Oh, boy.
They're fun films,
so,
though.
Yeah, they are. They are very fun films. They don't really make films like that anymore, you know?
So, I still remember that. Sorry?
What have you been?
I was going to say, on Lethal Weapon, I still remember the love scene in Lethal Weapon 2 in his caravan with the South African girl, who apparently is a rock star in real life. So yeah, but that's a vivid memory of my childhood and being kind of embarrassed to watch it.
You were so young when that came out.
Yeah, yeah, but I was like baffled by it a little bit and a little bit like confused. It's probably like, I'm sure teenagers have watched 300 and had a similar experience in the love scene in that. Do you know what I mean? So
I do, yes.
Yeah, and that's one of films in the 80s had just way more love scenes, didn't they? If you really,
they did, and it's interesting. There's like nipples and breasts all over the place, even in Die Hard, because I watched all the Die Hard films, and even in the first one of that, there's like a topless woman running around, and I'm like, what?
Yeah, like when, remember that. During the Christmas party, they break into one of the rooms and those films have great music by Eric Clapton and Michael Kamen, by the way. Great soundtracks. That sound, the saxophone thing and the wailing guitar. Ah, yes. Good times. So that's all? Oh.
That's all. Sleeping and watching Lethal Weapon is worse. We're not working. I suppose it's worse ways to spend your week.
Couldn't you have read more comics while sick?
Well, I was reading all these love comics because you forced that upon me, upon my person.
Aren't you going to talk about your love comics?
I have got to talk about my love comics, but, you know, later when we get into that theme.
Oh, I didn't even know we were doing a theme. I'm definitely not prepared for that. I read As a Bargain, because I'm prone to finding a book when it's at a really affordable price and grabbing it then. That's just me. There's a reissue of Art Spiegelman's Breakdowns, which was a book he originally published back in like 1978, I believe. 1978. I can't believe I got it. It was a collection of his first comics sort of prior to Mouse. And at that stage, he was like an experimental kind of guy, so very much playing with the form in every sense. So this reissue is in a beautiful, nice, big hardcover. comes with a new comic book introduction, and like the range of stories here are interesting. I mean, as formal experiments, they're fun, but they're obviously not his strongest work. I mean, Prisoner on Hell Planet's probably one of the best ones, and that's already collected in Mouse. A great piece here has him sort of breaking down the workings of a joke. So the first four panels are the joke, and then he breaks it down and looks at all the different parts. And if I changed this, would it still be funny? If I changed this, would it not? There's a great one which is about Ace Hole Midget Detective, where he plays with art conventions. So like he has a dream scene where it turns into like a Picasso scene, and he's this tiny little guy. Graphic design, all that, like really all these little elements come into it, and all the pages are like experiments. There's one where he does like this soap opera thing and the channels start changing in each panel. And there's a precursor to Mouse, which was the story he did before really delving into his dad's history in that sense. So, I mean, it's worth checking out in that regard as a kind of document of what people were doing in these magazines in the 70s. And, I mean, it's not, if I'm being honest, it's not his strongest work. But if you're at all, if you're curious about Mouse and you want to see what he was doing before, because really, Mouse is much, much simpler and much more kind of in how it's told than a lot of these other stories, which are just experiments. And you know how experiments can be hard to find. They can be a bit tedious after a while if you read too many of them, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. But sure. It's still a really awesome book, quite affordable, so I'd recommend checking it out if you're all curious about his other work. Yeah, that's the only comic I really read. I mean, the only other thing I read this week that I did want to mention is The Fine Magazine, issue 4. Now, this has nothing to do with comics. Okay. It's a hip-hop magazine run by a Dutch guy who's a really nice dude. They've been doing the online magazine for 3 issues, and they finally launched the physical mag, and it's going quite well. It's all underground hip-hop stuff, so across Europe, Japan, and it's got so many good artists involved, and there are some interviews of some Australian hip-hop artists as well, so it's relevant to us here. So order yourself a copy. It's an online order thing, and if you're at all into hip-hop, there's a free CD sampler thing that comes with it as well. It's all jazzy stuff, mostly instrumental. I reckon it would appeal to a lot more people than they might think. So, yeah, that was the other thing I just wanted to mention. The Find magazine. What? Google them.
What's the website? Okay.
Thefindmag.com.
Sure.
Yeah, all right.
Now let's talk about lovey-dovey stuff.
Let's go. You've got some romance you've got some romance comics you want to talk about, Christopher?
I do, Maladdin. Ooh, baby.
Good radio, my friends. Okay. Good radio.
So we thought that we would talk about lovey-dovey romance comics because it's a belated Valentine's Day look at such things. Did you get anything for Valentine's Day or purchase anything for your beloved red-headed woman?
I did nothing for Valentine's Day, which in itself
was a romantic treat. I appalled by your behaviour.
What did you do for your loved one? What did you get your mum?
She's got everything what we could need.
You have me. You have the best son in the world, Mum.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I wait till her birthday. Get a new, fresh set of tea towels.
Oh, God.
So I actually had quite a few love comics. I was quite surprised when we came up with this topic. I've got, I probably got at least a dozen, but I didn't read through all of them. And the one thing that I discovered, most of them, all of them are independent. Most of them are black and white, and they're all quite depressing. So obviously romance comics as a genre was quite big in the 50s. You even had like Jack Kirby working on romance comics when the Comics Code kind of hit and there was no more horror comics being produced. But obviously there aren't really, I guess Archie, I guess, would be the closest we have today. But now we have romance comics, but they're more, either romantic comedies or the kind of story that you'd find in like a foreign film or an independent cinema release.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one I want to talk about is just a black and white digest by Oni Press that collects 3 mini graphic novels by writer Jamie S. Rich, who's a novelist, as well as a comics writer and artist Mark Ellerby. It's called Love the Way You Love, and the title is pretty cool. It was, as I said, released by Oni Press in 2007. Side A, Songs of Faith, is the one that collects the first 3, and then there's a side B also from Oni that collects the next 3. So it's actually, I found the similarities initially quite annoying because it's quite similar to Scott Pilgrim. The main character is in a band, his lead character, he runs into a girl in an airport, then kind of falls in love with her. He meets a girl in a gig, but she's engaged to this young record executive. Like, it's kind of got the basic ingredients of Scott Pilgrim, and the more I was reading it, with the wacky supporting cast and kind of cute asides, I was like, but it's actually, it does, once you kind of plow through that, it does actually have a life of its own. It's not as wacky or zany as Scott Pilgrim. So the main character is this guy called Tristan. He's like got this big spiky hair. He's the lead singer of this band called Like a Dog. He meets the girl, Isabel, as I said, at the airport, and then they end up passioning each other on their first meeting. And then she basically has to decide which man she wants to be with, Tristan or her fiancé, Marcus Lee, who is this young record executive, and of course, is a bit arrogant and unlikable. So it's actually pretty interesting. The character's quite well written. Like, it's actually a dialogue-driven piece, and it's actually not bad. So if you thought Scott Pilgrim was a bit zany, and you want something a bit more down-to-earth, then Love the Way You Love is a good place to start. Jamie S. Rich, the writer here, has also written a few other comics, such as You Have Killed Me, which I do actually own, and is like a kind of noir, a love noir detective kind of story, but I haven't read that yet. And he co-created Spellcheck is also for Oni, which is meant to be good. So the art here is black and white, again, kind of like Scott Pilgrim, but I guess a bit lighter. It's a bit crude, actually quite a lot crude in some places, but it still has a kind of quiet charm all to itself. So yeah, there's two volumes out now from Oni Press, and if you want something that's quite real, Love the Way Your Life Isn't Bad. And also I should point out that I found on the same topic through Rich's, Jamie S. Rich, through his blog, I discovered this webcomic called Somewhere in Between that's written by his friend Megan Levens, and it's described as a webcomic about love, life and unemployment. And it seems like it's fairly new. You can see it at somewhereinbetweencomic.com. And it's pretty cool. The art's awesome. Black and white, a page a day. It just kind of tells a story of this girl and her friends falling in and out of love and whatnot. It's kind of like Jeff Smith, who does Bone, kind of his kind of clean, cartoony kind of art. So, I just kind of ran across it today, so I thought I'd mention it, because, you know, sometimes our web comics can kind of get lost in the blogosphere, netosphere, because there's so many of them out there. But, if you're new to that sort of thing, Love the Way You Love isn't a bad place to start. It's not the best, but it's not a bad place to start if you're interested in kind of realistic romance comics.
Oh, cool. I didn't have any particular ones I wanted to talk about. There's a few I tried dipping into, and then I realized these aren't really romantic at all. I mean, if you want any kind of mainstream comics that'll satisfy the they're not romantic though, but the first one that came to mind was Tulip and Jesse in Preacher. I just love their relationship. That just made me think of that kind of loyalty.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, in the face of, and I guess there will they won't they tension of, I like the tension of Batman and Wonder Woman. Is that just me? I kind of imagine them ending up together.
Yeah, they kind of hooked up in the Justice League. They kind of hooked up and went on a couple of dates, because their personalities are kind of quite similar.
Yeah, I prefer that to Superman.
But I've always been interested in the Batman-Catwoman relationship, because they both know each other's secret identities. And, really, like the last couple of years, they've had a bit more of a romantic, I guess, friends with benefits, superhero friends with benefits, okay. I guess they'd be.
Do you remember the animated Batman? There was an implication that he, because in that universe, Barbara Gordon never got paralyzed, and there's an implication that there was a romance there
between Bruce Wayne and her.
Yep. You didn't watch? Did you watch Batman Beyond? Yeah, that was brought up there, and it was kind of this thing in their past. And I think you see them kiss at one point. It's like, what? But I thought
because in the comics, it's Dick Grayson, the first Robin, and Barbara Gordon, Batgirl, who hook up. They're not together in the comics now, but I do remember that, because it's quite weird, because it's almost like Bruce is a father figure, and it's like, it's a bit weird. But
that's why I was like, they were doing some interesting stuff on that show, and its various spin-offs and stuff. And interesting, I mean, in a good way, like, quite sort of, it's Paul Dini's influence, really. I guess you can sort of see, what would Paul Dini do if they gave him the reins to Batman after Grant Morrison? And I think he could do some interesting stuff if they let him really push it, because he writes good character pieces about villains.
Yeah, he has been writing
Detective Comics.
Detective Comics, not recently, but and also I think Gotham City Sirens or Streets of Gotham, maybe both of those titles as well, which are pretty good. And of course, he created Harley Quinn, didn't he? And Harley Quinn and Joker are lovers. Right.
Yeah, and that's one of the enduring comic book romances, actually. I can't believe we didn't mention that. Yeah, Harley Quinn, if you can't place her, is like, "Hello, Mr. J. Oh, pardon." That girl, if you can't imagine her, now you can.
Not quite that good, but yeah, Mad Love. Well, it was all about their relationship, wasn't it?
Yes, Mad Love, and there was an animated version of that episode, but if you can track down the comic, I think it's recently been republished, and that's really entertaining. It tells the story of how he kind of messes with her head while she's treating him as his therapist at Arkham Asylum, and she kind of loses it and falls madly in love with him, as the title suggests.
Yeah.
And there's he's an abusive relationship, let's be fair here. He does beat her up at several points, So it's not like a pleasant experience, but it's really quite like, wow, this is very unusual for like a cartoon which is drawn in this. I said cartoon which is drawn because it looks like a cartoon. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So it's quite striking.
That's there are a lot of in the world of superheroes. There are a lot of, especially in Teen Titans, X Men. Obviously, you know, Clark Kent and Lois Lane. They've been married for what, 15 years now. So there's a lot of anytime there's lots of superheroes together. There's always, you know, we know Emma Frost is sleeping with Cyclops, Scott Summers. So yeah, there's always that kind of dynamics. I think Superboy and Wonder Girl, I think, were going out for a while there.
Are they cousins?
That's kind of cool.
Aren't they cousins?
No.
Are you sure?
Superboy and Wonder Girl, not Superboy.
Oh, Superboy. Okay. No, okay, fair enough. that's disturbing. All right, fair enough.
But maybe if Frank Miller wrote them, that wouldn't stop him. Blankets. You've read Blankets, haven't you?
Yes, that was the one that was at the back of my mind. Yeah, I've read Blankets, and it's one of those books that that does stick with you as being a prime example of that.
It's awesome.
Biographical genre.
Published in 2003, Craig Thompson, and I should point out, published by Top Shelf as well. Mm. Craig Thompson, his next book comes out September 20 this year.
Ooh,
it's called Habibi.
Excited about that.
And it's 672 black and white pages. But Blankets is awesome. I was studying at uni when it came out, and I was kind of not buying a lot of comics back then because I was a broke student. But I had a copy of Blankets in the school library in the graphic novel comic section.
Of course.
So I picked it up, and this was kind of the turning point for me to understand how awesome independent comics were. It's 582 pages. It's black and white, and it's basically autobiographical. Well, at least semi-autobiographical tale about the young Craig Thompson growing up, and he's kind of ode to teen romance, wrestling with faith. It's drawn in such a beautiful style, and I think anyone who hasn't read comics before should certainly pick up Blankets. He talks about falling in love with Raina. He's this girl who meets at a like Christian camp, and their parents drive them to meet each other and stuff. And I mean, there is some kind of sex scenes and whatever, but it's not.
Tastefully done, Chris.
Can't
be offended by that.
It's very sweet. It's very delicate, and
that is very truthful.
I want to quote something here, actually, if I can.
Yeah.
This is just a direct quote from the book. Raina was the first to write after church camp, and her letter renewed my faith in the notion of making marks on paper. Her words were lonely and lovely and comforting, and they cried for a response. Thus, I found my muse. It's all very lyrical and deep, and kind of makes you want to cry and laugh in different places. And it's to me, I've read it a couple of times now, even though it's like a phone book, but it just reminds me of the potential of the comic medium. And I've lent this book to so many people that don't read comics, and they just fall in love with it instantly.
Yeah.
It's called Blankets, Craig Thompson. Get it.
I agree. I always forget how like really beautifully written it is. Like I always kind of think, oh, maybe I'm hyping it up in my memory, but it really is an experience to read. And because it has the length of something which you can really pour yourself into, it's not like a over before it starts thing. And it's so truthful. It really kind of parts of it really rung true for maybe parts of my life, and I think everyone can sort of look at that and go, because he doesn't like lie to you or sugarcoat anything.
Talking about real, I did want to mention Shortcomings. I don't know if you're familiar with this, Maladdin. It's by Adrian Tomine, who's one of those artists who is kind of like an independent kind of award winner who, I'm not that familiar with this work, but yeah, Shortcomings is kind of the first book of his that I've read, and it's basically a collection of something that was original stories that were originally serialized in his Optic Nerve series. So I actually read this probably a couple of years ago for the Extra Sequential magazine. So I'm just looking at my review here. So I'm just going to read it out because I'm lazy. Shortcomings, it's somewhat similar to the film Closer, but with a more ordinary-looking cast. Asian-American theatre manager Ben Tanaka is the protagonist, and for anyone who's been in love, you'll see your own recklessness through his stubborn eyes. Basically, he's been dating his girlfriend for a while, and then she gets a scholarship, so she moves into state. And then he's kind of all lonely and depressed, and his like best friend is a lesbian, and she's like this kind of witty person, and he's really not a nice person. He's very selfish when he's away, and he gets kind of jealous and selfish and wondering what he's up to when his girlfriend Nico is away. So he decides to go and visit her in New York, and then he discovers she has found somebody else. It's kind of like a Kevin Smith film in that it's very adult, and the language here is very adult, and this is one of those books that you wouldn't let children anywhere near, simply because of the language, and it's very real, and again, very raw and honest and truthful, and in some parts it does make you laugh, but more often than not, it is just such a real and harrowing book about how, well, I guess it's hard to kind of describe it as a romance comic, but it does talk about love, even though there may not be a lot of romance here, but it's people's relationships all intermingled with one another. So if you kind of like those independent dramas and, you know, whatnot, you know, if you like French cinema, Shortcomings is probably for you. It's the ending is ambiguous and open-ended, and it's a bit depressing in parts, but it is very good. I also did want to mention a book called Moving Pictures, which was published last year, again from Top Shelf. It's into specializing in these mature dramas. It's created by husband and wife team Catherine Stewart Immonen. Stewart Immonen is probably the most famous one. He's done a lot of pencil work on Ultimate Spider-Man and more recently New Avengers. And his style here is more kind of chiaroscuro, more black, white, very simple lines. Kind of the way that he draws the characters, sometimes they don't even have mouths, you know, it's just like two dots for eyes. But it's a very good written book. It's basically set in Paris in World War II. And Ela Gardner, who's one of the characters, she's a curator at a museum, and she's been questioned by this German officer, Rolf Hauptmann. And basically both are trying to value and catalogue the artwork in the museum, and he wants to know where certain pieces are. She's trying to protect them and smuggle them out, that sort of thing. Another very indie drama kind of book, very dialogue-driven. There's a great scene where Ela talks to a painting for like six pages, and then the books rather jumps back and forth in time to when her and Rolf, the German guy, first met, and then they start sleeping with each other. It almost seems like it's one of those French films of the 40s or 50s where, you know, the guys were tough and, you know, weren't in touch with their emotions and that kind of thing. It's basically just two main characters talking. There's no really scenes of the world at large. There's no scenes of the war. It's interesting. These two people, they're not necessarily likeable. They don't fall head over heels for each other. They're just together and almost sleeping with each other out of boredom more than anything else, just in this crazy chaotic world, just trying to find some peace and sense, you know. It's a very well-written book, and for a premise that could have been quite dark and quite depressing, it's actually quite an engrossing little book. And the scenes where the artwork is drawn are very detailed. The scenes in the museum, like just drawing the pillars and the floors and the texture and the walls, are all very detailed, even though the people are drawn in a quite simplistic, cartoony style. Again, it's one of those books that deals with raw emotions, and it's quite an ambiguous ending. But, it's called Moving Pictures, Top Shelf, and, published, created by a husband and wife team, Catherine and Stuart Immonen.
Lovely.
Great book that I can recommend.
Great.
I guess we should briefly mention Scott Pilgrim as well. We've talked about that enough, but that's a good update in modern romance tale. It goes for six volumes, and that's using love as the motivating factor for the main character. Scott Pilgrim is certainly a romance book, I would say, amongst many other things.
Yeah, and you're right, we have spoken about it way too much, so I do want to move on.
Yeah,
I think we should get into our feature review before we run out of time. It's
Let's do it.
All right. The book we're reviewing as a feature review, and it's a Nui. It's called Ivy by Sarah Oleksik, and it's being published by Oni Press. I should have known that.
Yep.
And it's a long piece, actually, going into hundreds of pages, 224 pages.
220, yep.
There you go. And the story itself is an autobiographical piece telling the story.
Is that autobiographical?
It seems autobiographical, or at least partially, and the girl's drawn like how the artist looks. So
yeah, it could be.
Because Blankets is, I think, is fully autobiographical. I think this might be too. You might be right. Maybe it's partially made up, but parts of it really strike me as fairly true. But to explain it. She's a kind of normal high school girl, art class kind of girl. They go to, they go visit all the unis, or that's colleges if you're in the US, universities like college for Australians. They go to all the art colleges, like without telling her mum, and she kind of meets this guy who she sort of gets enamored with in a long distance relationship, and as teenage long distance relationships go, the realization of the kind of person you've built up in your mind is less beautiful than the one, or more beautiful than the one you actually meet, and that's kind of what happens here. So the story has the drama that unfolds. They go, they run off and go hitchhiking together, and that sort of ends not in disaster, but just in disappointment and underwhelming. And then she sort of realizes through the course of things that she's distanced herself from her friends, but and she doesn't get back together with me at the end, so that was interesting. But I mean, as a story, how did you find it? Were you were you engaged? Were you brought along? Was it something you could relate to?
I think no, not at all.
Okay.
My sad tales of romance, I have yet to find something relatable. But I guess because Blankets has wowed me so much,
right?
Even though, you know, I've read it, 5 years ago. So whenever I read a coming-of-age tale about first love, I'm kind of, I'm already in a mindset of like, you better wow me.
Right.
But I must say, this was pretty impressive. I mean, I think Blankets is on the end of the scale of beauty and innocence and purity,
honesty,
and love.
Yeah.
And honesty, yeah. Whereas this is a lot more raw and honest. This is almost like something like, oh gosh, what's that guy? Harvey Pekar would do. You know, this is
really,
it's a lot more unflinching and, you know, a lot of profanity and drug use and sex scenes and a few boobies here and there. But yeah, Ivy just seems, you know, Blankets is on the scale of, you know, beauty and French movie kind of, and this is almost like an independent, you know, almost like Skins or something like that, I'd imagine. It's a lot more real and mature, don't you think?
Yes, in part, yeah. I mean, the approach is a lot more, I guess with Blankets, the whole story is framed as his memories, so he's narrating as he kind of as he remembered it, whereas this doesn't have a narrator. Yeah. It's just sort of told as if it's happening just then. So part of me is thinking, how is she remembering things? I guess I do kind of miss that, hearing the author's voice. And for me, a good autobiography of someone's coming of age should have their voice as they are in the present, so you can get a feeling of, well, what are they remembering wrong? Do you know what I mean?
That's a good point. A good point, yeah.
But this is, it's told, yeah, I guess you're right, a little bit more unflinchingly. She, I don't think she sugarcoats the things she does wrong at all in this. I kind of was afraid, oh great, she's going to paint herself as the one who is hard done by, but she doesn't really in the end. It's, I mean, if you're into these kind of autobiographical tales, and I kind of am, this is a pretty good example of one. The artwork reminds me a little bit of Scott McCloud's work in Zot occasionally. I don't know if you know what I mean, but like, especially how he draws, how she draws characters' faces and the kind of ranges of expressions she goes through. There isn't a whole lot of sort of too much stylishness going on in terms of how she's approaching it. It's more matter of fact. It's kind of refreshing in that sense, and it's a fairly long read. So you've got to divest a bit of time into it, and some parts are more interesting than others as you go. Overall, it's a reasonably satisfying experience. If you're into these kind of novels, I think you'll get more out of it. If you're not, you might not be converted by it. And it's not fair to compare it to Blankets, is it? Because it's kind of like...
it's not. It is a different beast. I think this is... It is very kind of an unflinching look at, you know, first love. And you're right in that it's no holds barred. It's like a warts and all look. Mm. You know, Ivy's kind of, you know, and her friends, they're all kind of very relatable. Well, very understandable characters. They're all multifaceted, and they're all kind of obvious teenagers. You know, they all kind of best pals one day and then won't talk to each other the next day, which seems to be how I remember high school, the kind of up and down relationships that you have with your friends or whatever. Everything's like the end of the world and everything's a big drama and
for sure.
You're screaming at your parents and whatever. The artwork is actually quite good, I must say. It took me a while to get used to it, but it's her figure work is very good. Like, it's all very realistic and rounded, and it's not filled with, you know, pretty beautiful people. These people all look like actual real people, you know what I mean? Like you said, the expressions are great. Her facial work is awesome. You can tell when she's shy, when she's embarrassed, when she's angry. Black and white with like grey tones, and there's a lot of detail here as well. There's no blank backgrounds. Like, she draws everything. She fills the page. She fills every panel, which I like. 220 pages of that kind of art approach must have taken a heck of a lot of time. I did find it quite enjoyable. It's one of those books that doesn't have a happy ending, but and at some points the character can kind of be unsympathetic, but then you realise, hey, I was a teenager like that and I hated the world and my place in it at one point. But you kind of, like I said, after realising that puppy love can sometimes turn into a wolf. Wow, I should use that for a movie poster tagline.
That's terrible.
Pretty bad, isn't it? she kind of wakes up and goes back to her friends and her mum and stuff. But during her journey on the road, I never felt that there was any filler scenes. I felt that every scene, every time she hit tight, every time her and Josh, who's the guy that she runs away with, kind of fell in love and talked, I felt that every one of those pages and scenes was necessary. And as you said, as a book that is driven only by dialogue with a few letters and diary and excerpts thrown in for good measure, it's so important to have that character and the dialogue just drive the narrative. And that does work quite well. And the story never becomes too boring or never becomes too unwieldy. That's important for a book of this length.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain parts in it which I didn't care for, like she'll have these daydreams and then a thought bubble will appear above her head, and that just, I haven't seen a thought bubble with like a picture in it in so long in a comic that it kind of like, whoa, this is old school. Like, I get maybe the impression, I don't know, that didn't work for me. Like, just little things like that, but it might just be because I'm not used to this genre. But I've read a few of these kind of in the Mome collections and those ones that come out. And as an example of that style, it's pretty good. I don't have too much to say about it because it kind of, the story does, I get the feeling of parts of, it was unfair to me to say it's autobiographical because I'm sure bits of it draw on her own experiences, but there's no way this is all autobiographical, especially since the character's name has changed and so forth. It did remind me of my art school classes, of my my art classes in high school, though. Really did. The jealousy of against someone who was just really put the, like, there were always people who put the effort in and were good at it, and there's this one girl who they all hate just because she's good at the subject, and they just decided they're going to hate her. And it reminds me also how much I hate teenagers because they do just they're so self-obsessed and just don't really care about each other a whole lot. So to the point where in this novel, like, her friends just get annoyed at her at some stage and they don't even give her a chance to make it up to them. They just turn bitchy.
No, it's not much of a support network, is there? There's a guy, one of the popular girls, her boyfriend kills himself, and then they kind of start this club, and then she gets kicked out of the own club that she started. And it doesn't seem that it's not filled with a lot of nice people.
Teenagers aren't nice people. Adults,
this is the kind of book you should give to teenagers. So, see, this is what you're like. Because, when you read it as adults, you're like, wow, we were like that, weren't we? It's kind of embarrassing. Little drama kings and queens. But
overall, like, it felt truthful, and that's the main thing for this kind of story. There were a few parts which just seemed melodramatic, like there's a scene with a broken bottle towards the end. I don't know if you remember that.
That
felt a bit melodramatic to me, and just like, okay, no, that's too far. But mostly it's very honest. I like her private spot. That was a nice little touch. You know, the half cut off bridge. It's a nice little theme for her own state of mind. You know, the bridge which is going to nowhere, so she feels aimless.
Good point.
I'm not above noticing these little. I know what you're up to, Sarah Alexic.
Yes, I didn't even notice that, but that's a very good call. Yeah.
Subliminally, you took it in. You took it in and it, you are overall recommended, kind of?
I would recommend it. Be aware that it is a very adult comic. There is, you know, like drug use and sex scenes and lots of profanity.
It's just pot, though.
But if you're into that... Oh, so that's a cat, is it, right?
It's not a drug.
You young people, we've got to bring this country down. I would recommend it, but I guess it is for a very... I think for someone who's kind of read comics before and likes the kind of indie drama kind of stuff.
Yes.
But if you only read superheroes, then this isn't going to change your mind.
Well, luckily no one listening to this show is like that, of course. Anyway.
I did enjoy it, though, and I've got to admire someone that can create 200-something pages of something that's so realistic like this. I mean, that's no mean feat, so that's admirable, and something that's largely entertaining is, you know, definitely worthy of two thumbs up.
Yeah, sure. I'd recommend it too. And as you said, the backgrounds are really quite pretty to look at, especially since they're distilled. Like, they're drawn simply, but they're very effective. So I'd say that's a surprise in this genre where backgrounds tend to be ignored as well. Jeffrey Brown, looking at you. Anyway, I think that wraps up our meandering kind of going nowhere review of Ivy. That was by Sarah Alexic, Oni Press, if you want to check it out. Phew. All right. That was our kind of romancy themed, it was more relationships, it wasn't romantic, was it, episode?
No, I think we used the term rather too liberally, because as I was reading these books, I was thinking, geez, none of these books really make me fall head over heels in the idea of love. Or but I think, you know, that's what love is. Sometimes it's very confusing, and
that's why I'm bummed that we couldn't get our special topic to happen. But I'd still like to arrange that, because it's very intriguing. So maybe even if it's not Valentine's Day, we'll do romance manga, because it's a genre which is very different from anything we have in the West, really. So,
cool.
Yeah, I'd still like to do that. Anyway, I think that's all for this week.
Yeah, thank you for listening. You can listen or download all our previous podcasts on extrasequential.com, also on iTunes. If you want to email us any future themes or perhaps romance comics that you've read that you've enjoyed and would like to recommend, you can email myself, Chris with a K, K-R-I-S, at extrasequential.com.
Yeah, please email Chris, not me. And music for the show is at purgeaudit.com. And I have a new album out there, so plug.
Yes, just good work.
Thank you. And I guess you'll be hearing us next week in whatever topic we decide to do.
You sure will. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
Thanks, everyone. See you, Chris.
Bye-bye. See ya.